an interesting career in a few ways. A lot of years in the second division clubs, and then suddenly you wind up, it must have been like being, well, going to heaven or something, you wind up with the Yankees. And, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, that's quite a finish.
Yeah. Yeah, because I, when, back my last year in Kansas City, which was 1959, I guess, I had pretty much made up my mind that I was going to get out. We had started a business here. My dad had started a business here at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I had had 9 years in there, and then, I mean, things didn't look any rosier at that time, so, I, you know, I figured, well, that was enough. And with the family was young and growing and all that, and I wanted to get my roots back here.
Mm-hmm.
And got a call one day from the Yankees, and said that they just made a trade. Roger Maris, myself. I forget it was five or whatever.
Yeah,
it's almost Kent, too long Kent ago. Hadley. I can't remember that long ago.
Well,
to
I,
be
can,
honest with
I
you.
Can tell you, it was you and Maris and Kent Hadley.
Yeah, Kent Hadley.
Or Bauer,
right.
Don Larson,
right.
Norm Seaburn, and Mark Thornberry.
Yeah, that's right. I was just back to the reunion, 61 Yankee reunion we had in July. Bauer mentioned me. He says, "You're the guy that sent me to the second division."
Yeah.
But yeah, so I they just said, "Well, we want you to come," so I kind of talked it over with the family and said, "Gee, you know, Yankees."
Mm-hmm.
In those days, it was pretty definite that you would be in the money,
mm-hmm,
to a point anyway, so they said, "Well, yeah, let's go." So I did my best. Best move I made.
Yeah.
Except the worst move I made was 2 years later, when I finally retired after 61, when they came out here and played the Giants, and they had won,
mm-hmm,
they played the 62 series right here in my hometown.
Yeah.
Practically. And that's the only regret I really have of not staying. I could have stayed. They called me in with, there was about a week to go in the 61 season, Ralph Houck, and said, "Hey, come on, we'd love to have you. We want you here." That time it was, of course, Gil McDougall had retired after 60, and it was myself and I'm trying to think of, oh God, I'm terrible, I can't think of, he played for Baltimore for a long time, and then he went to the Yankees with me.
That's why I bring all these with me.
Gosh,
61 Yankees, shortstop?
Yeah, infielder, yeah.
Infielder? Well,
no.
Tresh was there.
Yeah, Tommy was there for a while, yeah.
Yeah. Bill Gardner.
Billy.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Gardner. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Billy and I were the reserves. And then but I had pretty much made up my mind.
A man who walked away from the Yankees. Well, they're still winning pennants.
I don't know, Houck still gives me a bad time when I see him.
Yeah.
And, God, it was a great 2 years after 9 years. You,
mm-hmm,
know what I'm saying? I'm,
yeah,
sure.
Oh, yeah.
I never forget that I've told my kids, the first day I walked into spring training in 1960, and they took me out on the side, and they sat me down. Said, "Now look, just remember, every time you take the field, you're playing with our money." And that was, the thing has never left my mind.
Now who was it then?
It was like Scourin, Vera, McDougal at the time, the guys who had been there, you know,
mm-hmm,
gone through all these, and they were just it was just kind of an ultimatum, but in,
yeah,
a nice way. That every time you go out there, you're playing with our money,
mm-hmm,
and that's something that's always stuck in my mind.
I think they had lost in '59.
Yeah,
that was when the White Sox.
That's right, the White,
yeah,
Sox had won that year.
Yeah,
yeah,
and they weren't used to losing.
They weren't used to losing it,
yeah,
right? I tell you, and I can understand why they had it was a different attitude, different
mm-hmm,
altogether than all the teams that I had been on.
Did they take just you aside, or everybody?
At that particular day, as I recall, was me.
Yeah.
I was just sitting in my locker, and all of a sudden, I got about five guys around me. just talking, and all of a sudden they just kind of slipped into this little deal. And
yeah.
That's the way it is here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fine with me.
Yeah.
Nobody had ever said that before.
I want to take you back to the beginning. Who was the scout who first signed you?
Charlie Walgren, Boston Red Sox.
Walgren.
He lived in San Francisco.
W-A-L-G-R-E-N?
W-A-L-L, I think, G-R-E-N.
Uh-huh.
And Charlie and my dad were very close through semi-pro in those days. And my dad played a little semi-pro. And,
mm-hmm.
He got to know Charlie, and then Charlie started following me through high school in American Legion ball, and it was between, in those days, of course, it was between him and the Yankee scout was out there, and I can't remember the Yankee scout was looking at me too.
Joe
at
Devine?
That time.
Joe Devine still here?
Joe Devine was out here then,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And he'd been here 30 some years.
Right, and but Charlie had more of an interest in me than I think Devine did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they developed what they call they had a Red Sox semi-pro team made up of all Red Sox rookies, what they call the Red Sox rookies.
Mm.
It was all the guys that Charlie had signed in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was three of us from the high school that I played on signed with the Red Sox. And we all went to Class C in those days.
Mm-hmm.
San Jose. I played for San Jose and El Paso. And, finally went to Oneonta, New York, and then Birmingham, where I was drafted the White Sox.
Mm-hmm. In the baseball encyclopedia, it gives you the nickname of Oates.
Right. That was, there again, that was given to me by a very close friend of the family's here in San Anselmo in the playgrounds. I had, believe it or not, blonde hair. What was left? I had a lot of hair when I was very young, but it was blonde. And he one this day just popped out of him, and everybody kind of heard him and said, you know, just call me Oates, like grain, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me the rest of my life. And that there, and Al Zarrilla gave me the name Froggy. And I don't know where the heck he got that name. And that's been in a few of the books, too. But that one never wasn't my real. Oates
mm-hmm.
was the name that I still... To this day, guys will call me Oates once in a while.
Hmm.
They know of it through baseball.
Yeah, some of the nicknames in the books are
are
made up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no basis, but yours does. Who were the? You remember in your minor league managers?
Oh boy, yeah. First manager I played for, Marv Owen.
Mm-hmm.
San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
When I signed and with the Red Sox and sent to San Jose. And Marv was a terrific teacher of young guys,
mm-hmm.
and had the great experience of Major League behind him too, and then I went to played for Red Marion. I don't know if you remember Red Marion. It was Marty Marion's brother. He coached.
Mm-hmm.
He managed for a while. He managed the Oneonta Red Sox in New York. And then Eddie Papowski,
mm-hmm.
who was in this chain, and managed for the Red Sox.
Yeah.
He was our manager there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pinky Higgins at Birmingham.
Pinky Higgins was kind of a quiet guy.
Very quiet. Yeah,
yeah,
very laid back. Great guy to play for, I mean, as far as the young kids go, because, you know, he was so easy. He was like a father,
mm-hmm.
you know. Father image to you, and
and certainly in the lower minor leagues, you had to be.
Yeah, it was different. Yeah,
yeah,
it really was.
Was it difficult adjusting to in your first minor league season? Now you're playing every day, as opposed to
right
semi-pro
right.
ranks.
I thought. To best of my knowledge, I remember playing every day was easier to me.
Mm.
I mean, you basically knew where you stood in when you started playing regular. I remember the first, when I went to San Jose, I couldn't believe it. There was nine guys going out for shortstop behind me. I mean, when we'd go out there
mm-hmm.
during the spring, you know, and there was nine guys I was facing. I didn't know where I was going to end up. I mean, I didn't know from anything, believe me,
mm-hmm.
as far as professional baseball went. And when it was finally weeded out and we all got started and I was playing, it was just like going to the grocery store and coming home.
Yeah.
It was very, very simple. I felt the same way in the major leagues. The toughest thing to me in baseball is sitting on the bench and having them come in when you didn't know when you were going to go in. That was the toughest, to keep in shape.
Mm-hmm.
And there's guys that can do it. And I think that's one thing that's almost built into you or instilled in you, that guys can handle it.
Yeah.
Some guys can't.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it personally.
Did he give you a big bonus when you signed?
Oh yeah, $600.
$600.
I got $600, and we had to fight for that. And I never forget my mother at that time says, "Oh no, you can't sign that." And I wanted to play so bad that I almost cried. I said, "Let me sign, please, let me sign." And Charlie was over the house. He had the contract there. My dad and God, I wanted to play so bad. I could play for I played for nothing, but yeah. I would have played for nothing.
Mm-hmm. But they were looking for big bucks.
Oh, and the funny part was the kids that I played in high school with. I don't know if the name, you probably do know. Carl Olson went to the Red Sox. We all played at Birmingham. I think Carl got $10,000. The catcher, we had Bob Nelson at the time out here. He signed, and we ended up in Birmingham together. He got about $10,000. He never went anywhere after that.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl played about 3 years, and that was the end of him.
You had the longest career right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. And what was your salary?
I played for, let's see, it was $140 a month, I think, first salary.
Mm-hmm.
I played in San Jose and in El Paso, Texas. And when I went to Birmingham, Double A, it was like $225, $230.
I saw you play in Birmingham.
Did you?
I was in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
To Eddie Matthews.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good league. That was a great league.
That was a good league.
I'll tell you, that was one of the best leagues I ever played in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some good ball players come out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of them. And that fit the Atlanta team.
Yeah.
They won it. That was the first year they had a working agreement with anybody.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
It was with the Braves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they got Eddie Matthews there for the year.
Yeah.
And, well, of course, San Jose, you weren't very far from home.
No.
No.
No, that was a hoot and a holler for me. That was great.
Was that a everyday busing back?
No. We stayed at the YMCA in San Jose. We all just roomed it right there.
But did you have road trips, or was it every day?
Oh, no.
Day
yeah,
you
we
back?
Had. We No, we played, we had road trips. Stockton, Visalia, Ventura, Fresno. They were all,
what did you use, a school bus?
It was like a school type bus, you know, it had red socks on it. It was painted all red, I remember it, with the white socks on the side.
Yeah.
And, the trainer drove the bus for us.
We had a trainer.
Oh, yeah, well, cool. The trainer. he knew where the drugstore was anyway.
Well, I mean, that...
But it was big time out there, Norman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know. I've heard Cal Ripken say that his early minor league years were the most fun.
Oh,
in baseball.
Yeah.
After when you got to the major leagues, now it's a business.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Before it was just
absolutely. I agree there totally. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. It was like playing in upper high school type baseball because you still had some your friends around you basically, and you were just. God, we were 18 years old.
Yeah. But somewhere in the season you got shipped out to El Paso?
I did, yeah. They had a kid playing in San Jose who was on the same team. Ernie Sierra was a local boy. And he was older than most of us. And the working agreement then was like a partial working agreement. The Red Sox would give him a little money for this and that, but kind of control who would they wanted to play and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And Ernie had had a lot of experience, and it was a matter of either shipping him out, and that wasn't going to happen because he was a local hero down there. And
yeah.
So they sent me down to El Paso, and then the next year I came back.
Was that your first distance away from home?
That was. Well, actually, no, I'm that's wrong. That was my first, as I was playing. The Red Sox sent me back to Louisville after I graduated high school, just to give me a trip. They sent me to go to Louisville, stay with them for a while, and see how I, you know, get the feel of the game, so to speak, professionally. Then they shipped me up to Oneonta, New York, and sat there for a bit. I wasn't playing at all, of course.
This is 46?
This is 40, at the end of 46.
Yeah.
And see how I liked it, and then, of course, I came home and then went to San Jose.
Yeah, well, El Paso is another world.
Yeah, because when we went down there, it was owned by private people before the Red Sox got involved in it. And then they had all the Mexican players when we went down there. And here again, they're all the local, you know, heroes down there. And pretty soon they start infiltrating with me and a couple of other guys. Before you know it, we had the Red Sox took it over.
Here comes a guy from California.
Exactly.
Exactly. You were drafted by the White Sox. And then Paul Richards is the manager in 1951. How did he strike you?
Probably the toughest and best manager I ever played with. Smartest. And funny, because Eddie Robinson was here about this past summer, and I hadn't seen Eddie Robinson in over 40 years. And he and Gus Ernle came up to go to a ball game, a Giant game. He was scouting for Houston or somebody. And Gus and I are still very close. And so Gus said, gee, Joe's up here, let's all go to dinner. And I hadn't seen Eddie. And the first thing we sat down, we got talking about that. And he said he was the smartest manager he ever played for. This guy just seemed to be 2 and 3 innings ahead of the game. I mean, he almost looked like he knew what was going to happen next inning or the next inning. And every move he made was that way. But he was tough. You could not corner him to talk to him. You could not. If we were in this room now and we'd be talking, and all of a sudden you'd look around, he's gone. He would just walk away. He never got close to his player. Never got close. So he,
if you had something to
talk
over,
he
would
talk.
Go into his office.
That was the end of it. But don't just strike up a conversation with him, because it wasn't going to go. He just never got to a point where slap you on the back or, you know, kid around with you. No, I never saw much of that at all.
No words of encouragement.
Boy, you just wanted to toe the line with him. And maybe that was a good start for me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I learned how to keep my eyes open, mouth shut. I'll put it that way. And I think it worked out fine.
He'd let you know if you didn't like something.
Oh, I don't know if it's here, but I got to show you something that you'll get a kick out of. You talk about embarrassing moments. I'll show you this, and I'm going to set the stage for you on this one. And I have more fun with this when we go anywhere and talk to people. We were playing in Boston, Fenway Park, in 1951, and I was, of course, just the rookie there. Carrasquel was the shortstop. And Billy Pierce is pitching for us against Mel Parnell in Fenway Park. Now, this place is sold out, and at that time, it was like in July, we were in first place, the White Sox. And we went into the seventh inning. It was 1-1. But of course, in those days, no designated hitter or anything like that. And who's going to lead off with Billy Pierce? Top of the eighth. Richard, I hadn't been in a ball game in probably a month and a half. And as I said, trying to stay in shape. And even though I was young and you know, a lot more loose then, I it was still tough. Mm. And he looks down the bench and he says, "Demetri, get a bat." And I'm telling you, I felt like I was walking on eggs. And your whole life changes in front of you. I'm not kidding you. I'm what, 20 years old, 21 years old? Anyway, so I get a bat and I go up there, and it's a night game. And I'm leading off, and Parnell threw me a couple of pitches. Finally, he threw one, I swung. And I knew I hit the ball. I swear to God, I don't, to this day, I could never remember where it went. But I knew I hit it, and I knew I hit it good. Well, I take off, and I'm running, and it hits the fence in left field. Top of the fence. Well, Williams is playing left field. Of course, he just played that thing like it was like he was sitting in a rocking chair. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that. He just waited for the ball to come right back to him. He turns, he fires it in the second base. Bobby Doerr's playing second. I make the turn. I'm going. I don't even pay attention to the coach. I'm heading. I'm going. It's a double anywhere you go. And I get about a third away, and all of a sudden my legs don't want to run anymore. And they've got. I'm starting to go down. I'm starting to run this way instead of that way. And I ended up flat on my face, about from here to the fireplace from second base. And I just couldn't move, and I'm laying there. And Doerr takes, I'm looking, and Doerr gets the ball, turns around, and goes to tag me, and I'm not there. And he kind of looks up, and he sees me over there. So he walks over, and he says, "You're hurt." And I says, "No." He said, "Well, you're out." We go back home. We end up losing that ball game 2-1. Now I get up and I got to go back in that dugout. Richards is sitting down at the end of the bench over here. They had a restroom for the players was there right in the dugout, and it was a swinging door deal where you could go back where they had the latrine. There were 24 guys trying to get in there. They were laughing so hard, and they didn't want Richards to see. But they were pushing their way. Now I come down, here's Richards here, there's nobody here, and they're all over there. And I got to come in from second base at Fenway, right into that bench. Well, my wife had flown back to Chicago, the doctor, she was pregnant with our first child, and he said, "You can go back for a couple of weeks." Well, I end up, we went, go back home to Chicago, she's waiting for me with... I walked in the door, she's holding that up.
If there had been an ESPN, it would have made the highlights all over.
You know something? When Eddie Robinson, when we went to dinner that night, we sat down and we had just said hello to each other, and Eddie says, "I will never forget that night in Boston," because Eddie and I were still on the same, he was there too. He says, Eddie, you know, I got that picture. He said, "Well, you got to send it to me." He says, "I've got a room." He says, "But isn't that funny? After 40-something years, he remembered that." Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So that's my claim to fame.
But you didn't give me the end of the story.
Well, the end of the story was, it was just that Richard didn't look at me. I could see his face was just like, you know, "Well, you dummy, what the hell are you doing?" And that was, I learned a lesson there. Watch your coaches, number one, because this guy knew that Williams played that wall. I mean, mm-hmm. that, you know, a drive like that's a base, mm-hmm. just a single in Fenway Park, basically, unless it comes off kind of screwy. And
so Richards never said a word?
Never said a word to me, swear to God, never said a word. He didn't have to. I knew what was going through his mind. And of course, the other guys, they were.
How long was it before you was here again?
Well, it wasn't too bad. I got in some ball games after that. But I think, you know, the guy never talked that much. I think if he would have called me on the side or something, and mm-hmm. I don't care if he chewed me out or what.
Yeah.
You know, it would have made me feel better at the time. Mm-hmm. But I just knew that he was just inside, was just killing this guy.
And you learned that was typical of him.
Absolutely typical of him, yeah. But as a manager, he was top-notch, I think. Mm. He really did.
But he didn't explain to you what they call your role today.
No.
You might say, "On the bench 6 weeks, I might call on you, or you always be ready," or anything.
Yeah, nothing. Nothing like that. He was such a almost a loner type guy.
closed mouth.
And you know, the guy buried some smile. That was, it was tough. I don't know about the veterans who we had on the team then, how they accepted him, but I sure was.
Could you tell whether they liked him, didn't like him, or?
Well, there again, I think they respected him for his ability to manage a ball, because he took a team that after 20 years had never been in the first division, mm-hmm. and really had us in there. Mm-hmm. And he took, we had a pitching staff of Kenny Holcomb and Louie Aloma. Louie Aloma as a reliever was 9-0 that year, I believe. And Saul Roggeven, Billy Pierce,
mm-hmm.
And these guys were all...
Bob Kane didn't.
No, but
Joe Dobson.
Yeah. And
Randy
these guys...
Randy
Gumpert. They were all mm-hmm. veterans, you know?
Yeah.
And gosh, in terms, you almost say they were over-the-hill type pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys were winning.
And you finished fourth, yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
And there was some fourth-place money then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like $500.
Yeah.
Yep.
And your salary was?
$5,000.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
I made
$5,000 for 3 years.
I want to know something about Bob Dillinger. He had already been with the A's.
Yeah.
And Connie Mack just got so fed up and mad with him. And just, he paid a lot for him.
Yeah.
And then just sent him on his way in a very short time. He just, what kind of a guy was
Bob
Dillinger?
As I recall, Bob Dillinger was a tough guy to get to know and to be around. He was, I don't know, he always, some of his remarks were weird. And he wasn't with us that long, or I wasn't with him that long. But I can see what you're saying there as far as what Connie Mack might be thinking about Bob Dillinger. He's not the type of guy you want to have 9 guys like him on your club, as far as their attitude. It was an attitude problem. The guy was a terrific hitter, but he was singles hitter.
You know,
he was a line drive type of hitter.
I'm told that he was pretty stationary as a third base.
Very stationary. You're
mm-hmm.
right. He was in Pittsburgh, I think,
mm-hmm.
when did he come to us from Pittsburgh, or
he
after
Philly,
or did he go back,
A's.
Or did he just go to Pittsburgh after that? I can't remember, but I know he was at Pittsburgh and then with us at the White Sox.
He'd been with the A's before the White Sox.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
What do you say, attitude? How would you describe the attitude?
He never seemed to get involved in the things that maybe you'd be kidding around with. And his attitude would be almost like, you're nuts, you're crazy, it's not that way, it's this way. And
mm-hmm.
he had his own ideas about everything. He wasn't the type of guy that I personally would love to sit down with and just spend an evening with, believe me.
Yeah.
Because he didn't seem like a fun type guy.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, not being with him that long, but I remember that, you know, the guy was a cheater at the plate. I mean, he worked on all his bats. He had flat ones, he had grooved ones, you know, and I saw it, and everybody knew this guy did this, and he'd have a bat shaved, so you couldn't tell when you looked at it, but the hitting surface was almost flat, and then he'd have one, he would groove them a little bit, so when the ball hit, it would give it that, like a spin,
mm-hmm.
and I saw him one day get called at the plate, catcher. They were watching him. The guy, I think they knew him,
mm-hmm.
his reputation. And he argued like heck with this one bat, and the umpire said, and he's walking away, and he threw the bat down, grabbed another one. It was a different one with the grooves.
Yeah.
And then he'd go right back up there to hit a line drive somewhere. The guy could hit. He could hit those line drives all over that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
But, the as a third baseman, like you said, he was pretty mm-hmm. much in position there where it didn't make much movement either way, but he had the reputation and the name then of being a good ball player, you know, and being a very, you know, kind of guy you want at the plate for you, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But not as a as a team player, I guess I would have to say, pretty tough nut. He wouldn't be one of the guys that I would.
Yeah, after game, he goes on the way.
Oh yeah, he just didn't seem like he was part of the group. Mm-hmm. And probably I'll tell you, Eddie Juice could probably give you a heck of a lot more about him than because I know Eddie played against him for a while.
And Nellie Fox was there.
Nellie was there. Yeah.
Could you see? How far along was he as a player then?
He was basically just getting started.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we trained in Pasadena that year, in 51, Doc Kramer was one of our coaches. And I tell you, Nellie was on the verge of being let go or being shipped out. And I can remember that as like it was yesterday, because
mm-hmm.
Nellie and I were very close. And when Nellie used to bat, he used to have the regular stance, used the regular type bat, you know, and just didn't handle and all that. And just swing like a regular guy would be swinging.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't working for him. And one day, I'll never forget, we were playing, and Doc Kramer says, of course, he tells the rookies, you know, I'll stay over, I want you to shag balls. I'm going to bring Nellie Fox out, and we're going to pitch to him and want him to hit.
Mm-hmm.
And he took a bottle bat, one of those big old bottle bats, and he got Nellie out there, he says, here, take this, and just walk in there and stand there. And his stance was flat, this foot pointing out, and this foot right here,
mm-hmm.
right here. The guy started hitting the ball. And ended up with that bottle bat and went through his career.
Mm.
And it made him, I mean, it just made him a different ball player.
Mm-hmm.
So there again, you know, for a little guy, and as a second baseman, he was one of the guys that always went down on one knee to catch a ground ball. I mean, you don't see those things much anymore, but Nellie would go down on one knee if the ball was hit at him,
mm-hmm.
and to make the play. And you never thought of him as a guy who was going to turn out the way he did.
Yeah.
He was just so small, and he ran good. You know, he wasn't the quickest guy in the world, but he was small, and he looked like he was running fast.
Yeah.
And he just had a terrific career. But I remember that situation in spring training where he was very close to being sent out, because he just wasn't producing at the time.
Well, Kramer was one of the great singles hitters of the time, though.
Gee, yeah. Yes.
And then all of your trades were in the offseason.
Yes.
You never got disrupted.
Right. I was very fortunate about that. I really, to this day, I still thank God for that.
Mm-hmm.
I would hate to be moving around every time you looked around.
Yeah, that could be real.
No, it was. It was always in the offseason.
What was your reaction to the trade going to the Browns? You start out with the Red Sox, and they won a pennant in 46 all that kind of stuff.
I tell you, that turned out to be kind of a horror story, really, for 1 year of my life. And I still wasn't playing regular then, because Marty Marion was my shortstop.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger Hornsby was the manager.
I wanted to ask you about your part in the revolt.
Jesus, I tell you, if it was done again today, we'd do the same thing over again. That guy was something else. He just, you talk about tough for a young guy to even be involved with. The guy had the records, and he might have been the greatest of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure he was, but to be around people, to try and teach them, no way. Because he tried to teach everybody his way.
Mm-hmm.
And he always said, the only player, his statement, I never forget, the only two players he ever would pay to see was Jim Rivera and Clint Courtney. I don't know if you ever heard that.
But I know who you're talking about, and I can't imagine why you would pick those two guys.
Exactly, because Rivera was a wild man when he ran and played the game, and you know he did everything. And Courtney was a real tough type of guy, got in fights all the time.
Who couldn't throw the ball?
Could not throw to the ball pitcher. Exactly. Through these, and the first thing when Clint was catching, we'd walk in, we'd get behind when there's a man on first, the second baseman would watch the bag, and I'd go in and stay between second and the pitcher in case he threw it over his head.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah. So,
and
you know, we played an exhibition game at Seal Stadium, and he wouldn't let me come home because I lived across the bridge, you know, we were in town, but he wouldn't let me come home to stay over here, which was no big deal. And I thought it was kind of lousy, but we finally got to Boston and during the year and said, look, we all just got together, and Bill Beck came in and said, hey, this guy's got to go. Or I tell you, there was guys who weren't going to play.
Well, did he get on you about reading on the trains and going to
movies? No, he never, at least not to me. I never got involved with any of that kind of stuff. And maybe he did. It doesn't surprise me if he did. He just absolutely hated, the pitcher. Oh, isn't that terrible?
No,
one of the great, the black pitcher. Satchel Paige.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I can see that,
oh,
yeah.
That was terrible. But old Satch could handle him. We were playing in Burbank, that's where we trade that year. And the field was like over there, and every morning we had to go way out in this other field. It had two fields, and we had bleachers. We all had to sit there, and Hornsby would go through whatever he was going to do that day. And one morning, the first morning, we're in there, and no Satch. Well, now Satch stood out like a sore thumb because he was the only black guy on the team, right? And all of a sudden, he's got his back to us, and we're sitting up like this, and he's talking this way. And we look down there, and here comes Satch. And now he's almost crawling. And now the guy's like 6'4", and he's coming out like this. He's going to sneak his way in. Well, he got out there, and that Hornsby just got on him. He says, I'm fining you $250 for this. And he just went on and on. And old Satch just stood there and took it. He said, no, Mr. Hornsby. He says, I don't think so. He just picked up the phone, go in, call back. And that was the end of it. Oh, boy. Now, and then, that's when Marty then, in fact, we gave him a trophy. We gave Bill Beck a trophy. It stood about that high.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, okay, he says, he's gone.
Was there a leader in this effort?
Well, I think Bobby Young, who was a second baseman, it was a team effort, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, in fact, I'll be honest with you, I think even Marty Marion might have had something to do with it.
A mutiny needs a leader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would have to say, Marty and Bobby roomed together. Marty, Barry, and Marty became manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't swear to it, but I would have to say that they really maybe got the ball rolling. And of course, everybody just jumped right in. I mean, it was pretty bad. He was just...
Did you have any team meetings about it without him there?
We just had that day, that one day there, that finally that everything was kind of broke loose.
And who took it to vet?
I don't know. I don't know whether it was Marty or Bobby, because Marty was the captain of the team, and he said we're going to. Beckett's flying in, and we're going to get and Roger's gone, and that's how it was presented to us. And we said, oh, great. Well, that's when we said, well, let's get him a trophy. That's when everybody went out and chipped in. We got this huge trophy.
So it wasn't like the Cleveland Crybabies of 40, where about six of them went in to see the owner.
No.
It wasn't that way.
No.
I'm sure Beck was aware of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Who were the coaches?
God, we had coaches. Boy. Did we remember Johnny, we had a little short guy, and I remember a little roly-poly guy, had played some, didn't play very long in the majors, but was there, had some time. He was the third base coach, and I can't think of his name. I can see his face, but I can't think of his name. But I really, Norman. Bill Norman was one.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bill was a pitching coach.
Well, the coaches usually are, I mean, you call them spies, but they're the guys who are watching and listening and everything and reporting, telling the manager.
But this was a team effort against Hornsby. There was no question about it from almost day one. You could see it coming because his thinking, I mean, he was just brutal on the players. God, it was terrible. That was the horror story, I think, in my career.
Mm-hmm. Would he every time, unlike Richards, who would sit there and say nothing, would he let you know right away if you did something he didn't?
Yeah, and I used to watch him once in a while. He'd be maybe working with somebody, and he'd say, "You can't hit that way. You got to hit this way." And he'd stand up there, and he'd hold the bat the way he held it in those days. And then you're just sitting there, you're just like, what are you going to do?
And as far as managing the game?
I can remember Bill Norman had a great facial expression once in a while, and he would sit there, and Hornsby would say something, and he'd look at you, with the eyes.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was on.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't take long. I don't remember how long he was really there. Does it say in there? It seemed to me that...
Do you think that Marty Marion wanted the manager's job?
Well, I don't know if he really wanted it. I do know that he was the only guy on the team that probably should have had it.
Yeah.
With his experience and all. But
what was Ned Garver's role in all that?
Ned was a veteran type player, and had the great year the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, 51. He had won 20 games or 20 something games, I think. And
he was on the World Series team.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So he had the experience too. But Ned was kind of quiet. He was pretty laid back type.
He's a good storyteller.
Yeah, that's what I understand. I haven't caught. I haven't seen him since then almost.
Mm-hmm.
And but I see that. The St. Louis Browns have a society also.
Yeah.
And I've never been to it, but I still get, the papers and they show Ned's always there telling stories and stuff. And it seems kind of odd to me because, as I recall Ned, he was the laid-back guy, You couldn't get him to talk. But like all of us, we talk more now than we ever did because nobody can touch us now that we're out of it. They can't find us anymore.
And then you were traded twice in the winter.
Yeah, that was a weird thing. That was
traded to the White Sox.
Let's see, I was the Browns. I went back to the White Sox and then to the A's.
And then to the A's.
Yeah.
With Eddie Robinson and Ed McGee.
Eddie McGee.
Ferris Bain.
Right.
Yeah. And what's your introduction to the A's? Say you never saw Connie Mack?
I saw Connie. I never met him.
Dykes is managing now.
Jimmy Dykes. We went from down here to a guy up here who was a real players type manager.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed everything. I mean, everything was so much nicer. And
it didn't change much was the division.
Division,
we were finishing
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. We just didn't win. Couldn't win.
Who did you negotiate your contract with the A's?
What's his name? It wasn't the Mac. It wasn't Roy. I don't think it think it was Roy or Earl Mack.
Was it Arthur Ayler's?
That's it, Arthur Ayler's. Yeah. Yeah, that's who I could see his face, but I couldn't think of his name. Yeah, and it was funny because in 53 I was still playing for the minimum. And
was it 6,000?
Five. Yeah, and the Eddie Juice blew his knee out. Blew his leg out early that year. And that's when I started playing. And so Hector Lopez and I played a lot of ball games that year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that after that season, when I got the contract, it was for the same money, you know, for the next year. And Eddie was made manager before. And so I was holding out. I held out for 6,000. And I'll tell you, it was touch and go.
Yeah. That's a big jump.
Boy, I'll tell you, hey. And so they well, you know, they sent it back. It was terrible.
Did you get it?
I got it, believe it or not. Yeah, I got it. It like pulling teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But God, we, you know, that they had trouble making their payroll.
Yeah.
I think we sold Allie Clark to get $25,000 for him or something to pay them. Mm-hmm.
Well, you show up in 53, you're in West Palm Beach.
West Palm.
And Connie Mack is there, isn't he?
He's there. He was around, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I just never was in a position.
Was it a travel arrangements and the places you stayed and just the whole general, I mean, it was in chaos at that point. Was that reflected in the way things were run? I mean, here you've been with, there were second division clubs, or at least the Browns were,
mm-hmm.
and Beck didn't have any money either.
No.
Was this being with the A's step up, a step down, as far as the whole operation?
Well, to me, of course, I was more concerned in whether I was going to be playing or not. And when Eddie got hurt and I started playing, that to me was, hey, this is a start anyway. I'm mm-hmm. playing. I don't have to worry about, you know, whether I'm going to be in shape to fill in a week or two or whatever. So I was playing regular then, and that to me was you know, what I was really headed for, hoping for. And I wouldn't say things were in chaos so much. Here again, I think Eddie's going to be able to fill you in on that.
Yeah, well, the front office was.
Because, well, you know, Earl Mack, I don't know, just a little I can remember and heard, he wasn't the swiftest running things.
No.
Roy was a different. Roy was more of a friendlier type guy, and Earl was like a, oh God, he running here, running there, and you didn't know what the heck was going to happen.
Mm.
But he was more the calmer one that I can remember.
Did you ever see Earl Mack play the fiddle in the dugout?
No.
I heard the story.
Well, it doesn't surprise me, believe me, because there was some stories I heard before I even got to Philly. When I think Lou Brissy was pitching one day, and Connie Mack says, go get him out. And so Earl goes out there and says, Dad says you're coming out. And he says, you go back and tell Dad. This is a story, I forget who told it, whether it was Allie Clark, and they tell it so well.
Mm-hmm.
You can just picture this little guy telling Brissy
mm-hmm.
that he's coming out of that ball game. And tell Dad says you're coming out. No.
Yeah, 50 was his last year, so you never saw Connie Mack managing.
No.
But everything as far as the travel and the equipment, everything was it was major league level.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. No question about that. Yeah, it was fine. It's just that, you know, we just had problem winning games.
Yeah.
And I remember the one thing though, with like we when we were leaving town, we played the Yankees, and when we were leaving town, it'd be late at night, and we were taking trains,
mm-hmm.
and we'd go to the station, and the Yankees had their train, and we'd be right behind them in the same train, of course, but different cars naturally, and they had a nice diner, and we had box lunches. So, I mean, there was just a little indication of you know. This we didn't
be,
have the money. The money was over here,
yeah.
in this train, not in this train.
this would be after a day game.
Oh, yeah. And then we'd have to leave town. We'd both be leaving town, going somewhere, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember they had the diner. But there again, you know.
You didn't dream that you'd be in that diner.
No.
Five years.
No, I sure did. Believe me. Sure did.
Well, that's a difference.
Yeah.
That's a difference. Yeah. Who was your roommate?
Gus Zerny. Gus and I roomed together in Philly and in Kansas City. Mm-hmm.
And did you learn anything from Dykes?
You know, I was very fortunate. At least I consider myself. I got to play for Eddie Joost, Marty Marion, and Lou Bucco. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're looking for teachers, if you're looking for guys who can play the game, my God, I couldn't have gone to college and got an education that would have helped me any more than what they did, mm-hmm. as far as baseball went. And that to me was something that I've always been able to hang on to.
But here is Dykes, who was a, you know, all these pennant winners.
Yeah, but you know, Jimmy was such a character guy. I mean, fun. He was a fun guy, and I think you know, him and Doc Kramer used to go round and round joking and throwing mm-hmm. rocks at each other. And when Kramer would be coaching first base and we'd be on the first base side, and he'd be throwing stuff at Kramer and Kramer would be throwing stuff. It was that type of a deal, you know.
He wasn't teaching.
Exactly. He just, mm-hmm. yeah, but he was the greatest guy to sit down and talk to. I mean, Jimmy would, anytime,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, again, it was a whole change for me from what I had come from. And
did he talk about anything you remember about his playing days for Tony Mack?
You know, I do remember. I wish I could remember most of it, but I do remember him sitting down and telling stories of how things were when he was playing. But I just can't remember, you know, stuff that was that far back. Mm-hmm. To be honest with you,
yeah,
it just doesn't ring a bell, but I remember what a fun type of guy he was and how easy he was to play for.
Mm-hmm.
And
did he coach third?
He did at times, yeah. Not all the time, but I'm trying to think of, I'm not sure if Wally Moses was our coach. We had Chief Bender, Bing Miller.
Mm-hmm. Simmons still there?
No. Yeah. No, Simmons wasn't there.
Well, those guys could have talked about the old days, too.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah, you were sitting there with history.
I know it. And, mm-hmm. You know, I remember old Chief Bender used to sit and tell stories. That's going back.
It's going all the way back. 1902.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Great guys.
He's
great guys.
I mean, we're talking about a guy now who's in his 70s, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're on
1880, yeah. I had a real good arm, and I used to fool around on the sidelines pitching, you know, I just throw into a catcher, you know. And he used to want to change me to pitch. I said, no. I said, I might be able to throw for 2 minutes here hard, but that's not going to last. They used to love to watch me throw. He'd come out there and fool around with me. But they were just neat guys. They really were.
And Pete Suter was there.
Peter was there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
His phantom double play.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
God, old Pete. He was terrific. Geez, he had one great year there when he was there. I don't know if it was there or Kansas City. He he was hitting well over 300 in the middle through the year. I think he made the All-Star team, or
I don't know if he made the All-Star team that year. But I don't know. Yeah.
Well, no, it wasn't in 54. And he hit 286 in 53.
Yeah.
Finished 286.
Maybe that was it, but he got off to a terrific start. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely terrific start.
Yeah, he's another fun guy.
You had a chance to talk to him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How's he doing?
Been a while.
Yeah, I heard he wasn't doing too well either. Like when I go back to the society deal, the guys tell me that.
Yeah, he hasn't been there.
Yeah.
And Bobo Newsom was there.
Bobo Newsom, that's right. God, I have another name out of the past. Yeah, well, he reminds me of a Jackie Gleason. I don't know why, but his stature and he was another real character, you know. And I'm still a rookie, basically. And all these guys have had all this experience stuff, and it's all over around me. It's all around me. And it was just great, because especially when I was in Philadelphia, and God, you know, we had, and the White Sox, we had Majeski and guys like that. Hank Majeski, and of course, Eddie Robinson. All these guys had seen it all and been up there a few years. And just I used to try to take in everything that they were talking about, because it was such great stuff. It really was. And then it wasn't until really I got over to Kansas City that we were kind of all in the same boat. And now we had all been up there 4 years or whatever, and we've kind of became the guys for the other guys that were coming in. But Bobo was this guy was a classic, an absolute classic. And boy, did he have a lineup bull. Jesus. I mean, this guy was unbelievable. He'd have been great on the stage. Because I don't know.
He could pitch.
He could pitch, right. Yeah. But there again, he wasn't with us that long either.
No.
He came and went.
He came and went several times.
Yeah.
And same with Washington.
That's right, yeah.
What was the condition of the Shy Park infield then?
The field that I remember that Shy Park wasn't all that bad. St. Louis Park was the one that I thought was a killer, that Sportsman Park. My God, same thing. We had two teams. You know, we had Cardinals, Browns, and then...
Until 54.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, and then with the Phillies and the A's, and the field was always being used, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And but I, as I recall, it wasn't that bad.
It was still well maintained.
Yeah. It was fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always you always got your problems, but the park that I really liked was the Kansas City Park. George Toma, was the groundskeeper there, and the guy was amazing. And to this day, he's still doing things all over for people that they call him in. This guy knew dirt, boy, I'll tell you. And he could make it any way you wanted. Any way you wanted.
Did your family join you each summer?
They did in Chicago. Well, not in Chicago, because my wife was pregnant. She just came back for a week or two. And she came to St. Louis, and she came to Philadelphia and Kansas City.
Where would you stay?
Philadelphia. Philadelphia, we're right there in the Italian neighborhood. It was the old Shy Park. It was like two blocks, row houses, so I just walked to the park, because I didn't have a car. And so I just...
What did you have, a room?
What they would call a house, but they're right, boom, boom, you know.
So did you rent the whole...
Yeah.
The unit.
Yeah, the unit, right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I remember there was an Italian family right next door to me. And this This guy used to wait for me to come home from the night games and want me to come in and drink wine with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be those hot nights, you know, and he'd be sitting, yeah. They all sit out in the porches then, and I'd be coming home at 12:30, whatever it is, and they're all out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd never let me get in the house. You know, being Italian, yeah. In an Italian neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
Just like New York, was the same thing. God, boy, they come out of the woodwork.
Yeah. Did a lot of the players live in that area?
No, there was not in that particular, like, I remember Zerny and them, they lived over in Germantown.
Mm-hmm.
In that area, but those guys all had cars, and so there was only a couple of us that lived really close to the stadium,
yeah.
As I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to walk over, so that was no problem.
Yeah. The during 54, are you hearing rumors? Is it are the players talking about what's going to happen? Where are we going to be a year from now?
No, I found out. We were home, and we went to Modesto to play in an Elks game, a charity game, and they had the major leaguers versus the minor leaguers. And we were coming home. It was late at night, and we were coming home. We had the news on, and it came over the radio that the Philadelphia A's had sold the team to Kansas City. And that's when the first time I'd heard about it.
It was a surprise?
Surprise to me, yeah. Yeah, I knew the team wasn't doing well as far as paying salaries and stuff, but
yeah.
But nobody ever just came out and said, hey, we're going to be gone.
And you knew that it was...
At least I didn't know it.
You knew it was for sale.
Yeah.
But there was a Philadelphia group that was trying to buy it.
Trying to buy
yeah.
it, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was kind of, at the time, I can remember, I thought that would have been great because it was a whole new area, kind of a rejuvenation
mm-hmm.
thing for, I think, to get away from that same old thing that was going on there, losing.
Yeah.
Even though we didn't do much better in Kansas City, but it was, they didn't care. The first year, they,
yeah.
Hell, those people had come out, we sold out, and they didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
They were having barbecues and coming from all over, you know. So it was a nice new beginning, I think, for a lot of us. And I enjoyed it. My wife just loved Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
That was of all the places we ever went. She just loved it there and made it nice for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you get more than $6,000 or anything like that?
Yeah, not a heck of a lot. Well, I'll tell you, the best money I ever made was my last year in New York.
I would think so, yeah.
When in fact, this is the thing that Hauk jumps me all the time. He says, you made more money by telling him you were going to quit than he says if you'd have stayed. Because he says, Hamey says, what do you want? I said, I'll take $23,000. He says, you got it. I said, okay, I'll be back. And that's the way it went.
Mm-hmm.
And when Hauk was managing me to this day, he says, you son of a gun. Yeah, Boyer told me too this summer mm-hmm. when I saw him. He said, you know, he said, you got part of my money. He says, I was trying to get some money, too. Of course, those salaries weren't that outrageous either there. You know, I was surprised to hear what the guys were making
mm-hmm.
when I was there. I thought they were making more. Maybe not a lot more, but more.
Yeah. Well, the Yankees were in a position to say, look, you're going to get another whatever it is, $7,000.
They always threw that at
yeah.
you. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're going to get that paycheck at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And so that was one of their selling points
mm-hmm.
for sure.
They were right in those days.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah. Those Kansas City teams were not bad. I mean,
no,
you look at the names.
Yeah,
anyhow.
Yeah. We had a couple of good runs. I think we won 14 straight one shot there in one year. I don't remember what year that was. But
and then Harry Kraft took over.
Yeah.
Very good year.
No.
No. But now you've got some. Well, the guys are getting old. I mean, some of the pitchers. They have Garver.
Yeah.
Murray Dixon.
Murray Dixon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, Murray was.
Well, you had Mickey McDermott there. One time.
Yeah. Not very long, old Mick, but.
Tom Morgan.
And Facano.
And Whitey Herzog.
Oh, Whitey, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you see a future manager in Whitey Herzog?
Nope. Sure didn't. I that one, when Whitey went to the Cardinals, and I just, because I hadn't seen him in years, and I just couldn't believe that he would be so successful.
Mm-hmm.
Managing. I saw Whitey about 3 years ago. He came out to a golf tournament I was in that year, and it's the first time I'd seen him in all these years. And boy, he was Whitey. Whitey was Whitey. There was another one that he was kind of a tough guy, but he had great success, and we had a bunch of good guys to be around, and like you say, we had Big Power, who was a terrific athlete,
mm-hmm.
Kind of tough to play with, but Vic kind of played his own style of game, but he was good,
mm-hmm.
You almost wish that he'd fall on his face or something so you could change him a little bit.
Yeah.
He didn't. I learned how to throw to a guy on a dead run for about 3 years over there, and he never got to the bag. Vic never got to the first base and waited for the throw. Vic timed the throw. He'd be running this way, and if you went in a hole and you caught backhand the ball and you come up looking,
he's not there,
and he's coming. You could see him coming, and you would throw. And the guy would make the play. I mean, I don't care, but he would make the play. But it just really, really got to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you, and was Roger Maris, was his nature such that you could, if not predict, understand what he had to, what he went through in 61?
In 61?
When you were with him in Kansas City,
Rod, how can I explain? I've been asked this question 1,000 times. Roger didn't know how to handle the press. I mean, to really know how to handle the press,
mm-hmm.
And Roger. Until he got to that great year, had never had to handle the press.
Yeah, in Kansas City, there wasn't that much to handle.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And this thing came at him, overnight, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And Mickey loved it, because Mickey, they stayed away from Mickey more. They'd go to Roger.
Mm-hmm.
And Mickey, I can just, to this day, see Mickey's face. He'd sit there and laugh, Of course, there'd be 50 reporters, and Roger's inside his locker, and he can't get out, and these guys are throwing these questions at him, and Mickey's sitting over there just laughing. But, he really got to a point where he was starting to make himself sick.
Yeah.
There was no doubt about that. And,
but he was never in Kansas City. Particularly... I don't know. Was he a particularly friendly, outgoing person, or?
Well, that's it. Roger was a friendly guy. He didn't know how to push it out, get it out of himself.
Mm-hmm.
He always looked like he wasn't the type of guy. I mean, when you talk, if somebody just come up and talk to him, Roger wasn't the guy to shake hands with him and, yeah, I'm Roger Maris, or and this and that. Roger would almost kind of look at the guy like, what's this guy want?
Yeah.
Or what's he going to say? And like I said, I knew Roger for many, many years. We both were in the beer business together with the same company. So we go back a long way. I understood it when guys would come in and say, gee, Roger kind of, I didn't know what to tell him. Because I knew what Roger was saying. There was nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
It was his way. His nature was. And a lot of guys didn't like it.
Would he go out after a game or something with 3, 4, 5
Oh, sure.
Guys?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, that was... It yeah. was no, that was... No, he was, Roger was a team player, no question mm-hmm. about it.
But quiet in a
but
room.
Very, yeah. yeah. And then some, he would say something sometimes, and Jesus, you know, you'd say, God, Roger, don't say that. I mean, it didn't ring right with whoever maybe he was talking to, especially when it came to reporters.
Yeah.
He would, if a reporter asked him something that maybe was, maybe not the greatest question, let's see. Roger would fire back, you know, he would just fire out mm-hmm. something that mm-hmm. would just say, whoa, what's this guy talking about? What does he want?
Yeah.
And I think that was the problem. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing, I mean, I, as well as I've known him, I've seen him do it. And yet to be with him was wonderful. He's mm-hmm. a terrific guy.
How would, in all these various cities, what, at that time, because I mean, we're not talking about all of television crush the
right,
today.
Right.
What was the player's general attitude toward the press, the radio and newspaper guys? Did they tend to trust them, distrust them, like them, not like them?
I think, you know, that's a good question. I of course, when in the teams, until I got to New York, we got to know the press close because there were fewer of them, number one. Mm-hmm. There was just, there was a certain ones, you know, like I remember Kansas City Joe McGuff and guys like that who travel with the team. And mm-hmm. you maybe only had two or three guys basically yeah. that were with you. They were like part of the team, you know. You knew them, you saw them at breakfast, you might have breakfast or dinner with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a different situation till we got to New York where you had 20.
Yeah.
And they weren't only 20, there were 20 some guys from very small papers, mm-hmm. Long Island News or whatever it might be, or mm-hmm. you know, Staten Island, whatever.
Yeah.
And those sometimes were the guys that created some of the problems because they didn't have the experience
mm-hmm.
of being a with a major paper or being around for years and years. A lot of these guys were very young. I remember that.
They are today. And they ask dumb questions.
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happened the same thing then, Norman. I think it was just, you know, it's just blown up today more because you got all this television. It comes into your house. You mm-hmm. don't have to go in there to find it anymore. It's there.
Yeah.
But it was the same story, I think, then. And I remember a writer at New York, and I wish I could think of his name, but he would never... If some guy said something out of context, he would never print it. Gil McDougal, when we went to Pittsburgh to play the Pirates in 60, Gil and I went out to dinner, and he had this, and this guy came with us, this reporter. He was a top reporter then. Richter, something like that. I don't know why I've got the name.
Reichler?
Or something.
Joe Reichler,
I think that was him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that no way when somebody says something that should not be printed, am I going to print it? And, mm-hmm. and Gil McDougal told me later, he says, this guy is one guy you can trust as far as anything that goes on. But, you know, that was a isolated case, I think, at the time.
Among the Philadelphia writers, who would you say, if a researcher like me asked you, what Philadelphia writers would you consider good, accurate reporters? If I'm going back and looking at newspapers of that time.
Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Art Morrow was, well, I understood, I don't know how true this is, but Art had a drinking problem. And
not uncommon.
And right, and that Kelly did a lot of finishing work for him on his mm-hmm. articles. Now that I remember hearing that.
But they would not be likely to make up stories.
No.
Some writers would.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. No, Kelly and Art were fine. I remember the brothers, the Richmond brothers. They were
in New York.
They were in New York.
Milton
and Art.
Yeah.
Because I think Art died or Milt died, one of the two. Because I just saw one of them back there.
Milt's still with the Yankees.
Yeah, okay. Milt is the one that we were talking mm-hmm. with in July. But I remember them. They came through. I mean, they were with me right through when I first went up there. We were with St. Louis, and, you know, I remember them coming around talking mm-hmm. and everything. And
And of course, I hadn't seen Milton in years and years and years, but I remember their names.
Now, of all the managers that you played for, the only one that hasn't been mentioned is Casey Stengel.
Oh, well. Casey, what can you say? What hasn't been said about Casey?
Well, you talked about Jimmy Sykes being around and around and all of it.
Casey, I'll tell you, Casey, to me, the year that I played for Casey, I'd have to say he was a psychologist. One of the best psychologists you could ever pay to go see.
I tell you, he told me the same thing. He wouldn't.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw him do something one day with Mantle that was unbelievable. Mickey, we were getting ready to change for a game, putting on our uniforms, and Mickey had a tough night, as he did once in a while, but he was hurting pretty good too, and he was there and he was wrapping his legs with the rubber things, and our lockers were like here, and Casey was office was there, and he could look out. And he knew that Mickey had a tough night. And he walks out, and Mickey's sitting there, and just kind of putting these things on. And he walked right over to him, and he got right about there, and he looked down at him. And he says, "You're not going to play today." And he turned right around and walked back. Before he got in his seat, Mantle was on there. Mantle was there. He said, "Don't you ever take me out of that lineup." And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
If there was any doubt that Mickey didn't want to play that day, he changed it by just saying, looking at him and saying, "You don't want to play today."
Mm-hmm.
And he walked away. And that really keyed me.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the way he was. He was great at that.
Yeah.
And, of course, his meetings, McDougal, I was with McDougal, and we would get in the locker, and we'd get back as far as we could because we'd start laughing. I mean, this man, you could not understand. No matter, he could talk all day long, and you just didn't know what he was talking about. And he talked, one day he had a meeting about the White Sox, Aparicio, Fox, and that. And he called him, he says, "They're no bigger than Coke machines." And he, "What do you mean they're no bigger than Coke machines? I mean, where does he get this stuff, you know?" And God, you're sitting in there, just the tears are coming down, you're just trying to keep from laughing. And he'd take his hat off, and he'd walk away, and then come back, and then he's gone, you know. Now go get him, you know. I mean, he didn't have to say anything to that team, believe me. But he did his job. He was great. I don't know if you saw the tape. A guy gave me a tape on the Yankees, and in fact, it was on Mantle. It was a tape on Mantle that had been done on TV. And it was before Mickey was sick, too, I'm sure, because he looked great. And it was an hour tape. It was the best tape I ever saw on Mickey. Or
was that the one with Bob Costas?
No. Well, you know, the way it was done, he was being interviewed, but you never saw the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't tell the voice. I it didn't sound like Bob Costas.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been, but now that I think about it, but it doesn't sound. And Mickey would, like, the camera was facing here, and he was in his chair, and he had some trophies and stuff, and he just talked. And they would kind of ask him a question, but he would just go into the story himself, and it just went on and on and on and on. But it was the best. I made copies of it and gave to my grandkids and said, "Take a look at this, you know, and really, really look at this and see what a terrific guy this guy is, or was," and which I thought he was the best I ever saw. To go through what he went through, I just couldn't. They had pictures of him running the bases; it was unbelievable. He just unbelievable. The only guy I ever saw run on his heels, and he could run on his heels.